Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. The cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so somber and a rain so penetrating that outdoor exercise was now out of the question. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight, with nipped fingers and toes, and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza, John, and Georgiana Reed. The said Eliza, John, and Georgiana were now clustered round their mamma in the drawing-room. She lay reclined on a sofa by the fireside, and with her darlings about her, for the time neither quarrelling nor crying, looked perfectly happy. Me she had dispensed from joining the group, until she heard from the nurse Bessie that I was endeavouring in good earnest to acquire a more sociable disposition. A small breakfast room adjoined the drawing-room. I slipped in there. It contained a bookcase. I soon possessed myself of a volume, taking care that it should be one stored with pictures. I mounted into the window seat. Gathering up my feet, I sat cross-legged like a Turk, and having drawn the red moreen curtain nearly close, I was shrined in double retirement. Folds of scarlet drapery shut in my view to the right hand. To the left were the clear panes of glass, protecting but not separating me from the drear November day. At intervals, while turning over the leaves in my book, I studied the aspect of that winter afternoon. Afar, it offered a pale blank of mist and cloud. Near, a scene of wet lawn and storm-beat shrub, with ceaseless rain sweeping away wildly before a long and lamentable blast. I returned to my book, Buick's History of British Birds. Each picture told a story, mysterious, often to my undeveloped understanding and imperfect feelings, yet ever profoundly interesting. With Buick on my knee, I was then happy. Happy, at least, in my way. I feared nothing but interruptions, and that came too soon. The breakfast-room door was opened.
"Bow, Madam Mope!"
cried the voice of John Reed. Then he paused. He found the room apparently empty.
"Where the dickens is she?"
It is well I drew the curtain, I thought, and I wished fervently he might not discover my hiding-place. Nor would John Reed have found it out himself. He was not quick, either of vision or conception. But Eliza just put her head in at the door and said at once,
"She's in the window seat, to be sure, Jack."
And I came out immediately, for I trembled at the idea of being dragged forth by the said Jack, who was then a schoolboy of 14 years old.
"What were you doing behind the curtain?"
he asked. "I was reading."
"Show the book."
I returned to the window and fetched it thence.
"You have no business to take our books. You are a dependent, Mamma says. You have no money. Your father left you none. You ought to beg, and not to live here with gentlemen's children like us, and eat the same meals we do, and wear clothes at our mamma's expense. Now, I'll teach you to rummage my bookshelves, for they are mine. All the house belongs to me, or will do in a few years. Go and stand by the door, out of the way of the mirror and the windows."
I did so, not at first aware what was his intention. But when I saw him lift and poise the book and stand in act to hurl it, I instinctively started aside with a cry of alarm. Not soon enough, however. The volume was flung, it hit me and I fell, striking my head against the door and cutting it.
"Wicked and cruel boy," I said. "You are like a murderer. You are like a slave driver. You are like the Roman emperors."
I had read Goldsmith's History of Rome and had formed my opinion of Nero, Caligula, etc. Also, I had drawn parallels in silence which I never thought thus to have declared aloud.
"What? What?"
he cried.
"Did she say that to me?"
He He ran headlong at me. I felt him grasp my hair and my shoulder. He had closed with a desperate thing. I really saw in him a tyrant, a murderer. I don't very well know what I did with my hands, but he called me, "Rat! Rat!" and bellowed out aloud. Aid was near him. Eliza and Georgiana had run for Mrs. Reed, who was gone upstairs. She now came upon the scene, followed by Bessie and her maid, Abbott. We were parted. I heard the words, "Dear, dear, what a fury to fly at Master John!"
"Did ever anybody see such a picture of passion?"
Then Mrs. Reed subjoined,
"Take her away."
Four hands were immediately laid upon me, and I was borne upstairs. As a consequence of my latest offence, it was decided that I should be sent away to a seminary for young ladies. I overheard Abbott and Bessie discussing the subject when they both sat sewing in the nursery one night, after I was in bed and, as they thought, asleep. On the same occasion, I learned, for the first time, from Miss Abbott's communications to Bessie, that my father had been a poor clergyman, that my mother had married him against the wishes of her friends, who considered the match beneath her, that my grandfather Reed was so irritated at her disobedience, he cut her off without a shilling, that after my mother and father had been married a year, the latter caught the typhus fever while visiting among the poor of a large manufacturing town where his curacy was situated, and where that disease was then prevalent, that my mother took the infection from him, and both died within a month of each other. Bessie, when she heard this narrative, sighed and said, "Poor Miss Jane is to be pitied too, Abbott." My first quarter at Lowood, the institution to which I was sent, seemed an age, and not the golden age either. It comprised an irksome struggle with difficulties in habituating myself to new rules and unwonted tasks. The fear of failure in these points harassed me worse than the physical hardships of my lot, though these were no trifles. During January, February, and part of March, the deep snows, and after their melting, the almost impassable roads, prevented our stirring beyond the garden walls, except to go to church. But within these limits, we had to pass an hour every day in the open air. Our clothing was insufficient to protect us from the severe cold. We had no boots. The snow got into our shoes and melted there. Our ungloved hands became numbed and covered with chilblains, as were our feet. I remember well the distracting irritation I endured from this cause every evening, when my feet, inflamed, and the torture of thrusting the swelled, raw and stiff toes into my shoes in the morning. Then the scanty supply of food was distressing. With the keen appetites of growing children, we had scarcely sufficient to keep alive a delicate invalid. As spring drew on, the privations, or rather the hardships of Lowood, lessened. The frosts of winter had ceased. Its snows were melted, its cutting winds ameliorated. My wretched feet, flayed and swollen to lameness by the sharp air of January, began to heal and subside under the gentle breathings of April. April advanced to May, a bright, serene May it was. Days of blue sky, placid sunshine, and soft western or southern gales filled up its duration. And now vegetation matured with vigour. Lowood shook loose its tresses. It became all green, all flowers. Its great elm, ash, and oak skeletons were restored to majestic life. All this I enjoyed often and fully, free, unwatched, and almost alone. For this unwonted liberty and pleasure there was a cause, which it now becomes my task to explain. Have I not described a pleasant sight for a dwelling, when I speak of it as blossomed in hill and wood, and rising from the verge of a stream? Assuredly pleasant enough. But whether healthy or not is another question. That forest dell where Lowood lay was the cradle of fog and fog-bred pestilence, which, quickening with the quickening of spring, crept into the orphan asylum, breathed typhus through its crowded schoolroom and dormitory, and ere May arrived, transformed the seminary into a hospital. Semi-starvation and neglected colds had predisposed most of the pupils to receive infection. 45 out of the 80 girls lay ill at one time. Classes were broken up, rules relaxed. I was one of the few who continued well and was allowed almost unlimited license. When the typhus fever had fulfilled its mission of devastation at Lowood, it gradually disappeared from thence, but not till its virulence and the number of its victims had drawn public attention on the school. Inquiry was made into the origin of the scourge, and by degrees various facts came out which excited public indignation in a high degree. The unhealthy nature of the site, the quantity and quality of the children's food, the brackish, fetid water used in its preparation, the pupils' wretched clothing and accommodation, all these things were discovered, and the discovery produced a result beneficial to the institution. Several wealthy and benevolent individuals in the county subscribed generously for the erection of a more convenient building in a better situation. New regulations were made, improvements in diet and clothing introduced. The school, thus improved, became in time a truly useful and noble institution. I remained an inmate of its walls after its regeneration for 8 years, 6 as a pupil and 2 as a teacher. And in both capacities, I bear my testimony to its value and importance. But towards the end of my 8 years, a change came over me. I desired liberty, change, stimulus. One night, I sat up in bed and proceeded to think with all my might. What do I want? A new place in a new house, amongst new faces, under new circumstances. How to get a new place? I could not tell. Nothing answered me. I then ordered my brain to find a response, and quickly. It worked, and worked fast. Those who want situations advertise. You must advertise in the Herald. So this I did, and received my first reply after 1 week. Indeed, it was my only reply. The contents were brief. If J.E., who advertised in the Herald of last Thursday, possesses the acquirements mentioned, a situation can be offered her where there is but one pupil, a little girl, under 10 years of age, and where the salary is £30 per annum. J.E. is requested to send references, name and address, and all particulars to Mrs. Fairfax, Thornfield, near Millcote. You must fancy you see a room in the George Inn at Millcote, with such large figured papering on the walls as inn rooms have, such a carpet, such furniture, such ornaments on the mantelpiece, such prints, including a portrait of George III and another of the Prince of Wales. I left Loughton at 4 o'clock a.m., and the Millcote town clock is now just striking 8. When I asked a waiter at the George Inn if anyone had been to inquire after a Miss Eyre, I was answered, "I don't know, ma'am. I'll inquire at the bar." He vanished, but reappeared instantly. "Person here waiting for you." I jumped up, took my muff and umbrella, and hastened into the inn passage. A man was standing by the open door, and in the lamplit street I dimly saw a one-horse conveyance. I got in. The man fastened the door, climbed to his own seat outside, and we set off.